This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Vincent van Gogh and Paul Gauguin worked together for 9 weeks in Arles, France in the late 19th century. While it was a brief period of contact, the time they spent with one another discussing art and painting had a tremendous impact on their work. It was pivotal for each artist. The influences van Gogh and Gauguin had on one another can be seen in an exhibition of more than 130 artworks now on display at the Art Institute of Chicago. The exhibition Van Gogh and Gauguin, the Studio of the South, is the subject of this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is the exhibition's curator, Douglas Druick. He is also co-author with Peter Cort Zegers of the book Van Gogh and Gauguin, The Studio of the South. The book also serves as the show's catalog. The exhibition opened in September. It continues through January 13th. The show at the Art Institute is its only U.S. venue. Listeners, I invite your questions for Douglas Druick. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Douglas Druick, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. The art critic for the Chicago Tribune says the Studio of the South is not a blockbuster, it's better. Alan Artner wrote in his review, the achievement of the exhibition lies in how it illuminates work that has long been well known and in some quarters taken for granted without having been fully examined. You know, with all the drama of the lives of these two artists and the drama of their work, why hadn't the relationship between them been examined in greater detail until recently?
Well, it's interesting what's happened because there have been lots of pages written about this relationship, some enormously insightful. But the sort of thing that we were trying to do could not really be undertaken by a private scholar or even someone at the university. That might be very difficult. Because one of the central questions has been, despite the fact that we know that they worked and painted together in Arles for these 9 weeks, that was the centerpiece of a relationship which, in fact, began earlier and continued up until Vincent's death in 1890, that was 18 months later, and beyond, certain key elements of what happened there have remained unknown. For example, it's not been exactly clear what they painted when together, which works were painted in Arles. There's been some confusion about certain pictures, whether or whether they were not painted while these two artists were living and painting together. And even more importantly, in the body of work that we know to have been painted while they were together, the order in which it was painted has been unclear. And if we think of these two men either out of doors painting in the fields or in the studio painting side by side, if we think that each time they set up their easel side by side and begin to paint as one chapter in a series of chapters, clearly it's terribly important to know the proper sequence of the chapters, because depending on how things are ordered, you'll have a different reading of what went on between these two people. And so what we decided to do was to tackle something that hadn't been tackled before. We knew that while the two artists were together, they went out and bought a very untraditional material to paint on. Usually artists paint on a linen-like material. They went out and bought this very heavy burlap-like material known as jute, which was used by upholsterers, among other trades. And its characteristic is that it's very rough and very hairy and very absorbent. And there is no tradition of working on this material, and it changes the way you apply your paint to the surface of what you're painting on just because it is so resistant. It doesn't allow you to paint with these great fluid strokes. What we did was we sent people around the world. What you have in a museum that you don't have on a university campus are scientists and conservators devoted to works of art. So we have a professional staff here that both conserves and analyzes works of art. Our people went into a partnership on this, a research partnership with our partners in the exhibition, the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, And they went around the world looking at the pictures and getting x-rays and taking fiber samples and studying these pictures under the microscope and even taking microscopic samples of the actual pigment, the paint that these people used. And as a result of this two-year endeavor, we were able to establish not only what are the defining characteristics, the thread count, for example, of the jute that they used in Arles. It's like, you know, jute is like any other material, like cotton. Cotton is, all cottons produced in different places are not the same. There are different, you know, densities mm-hmm. of weave and thickness of the fibers, etc. So we established what is the pattern, the fingerprint of the Arles jute. And we also determined through a chemical analysis that while they were together, they experimented with what we might call for a painting the priming layer, the ground layer, just the way you perhaps put a priming layer on the wall before you apply the paint that you want to apply. So too, when you get raw material, you have to apply a ground layer, a priming layer, before you start painting your picture. And that has to dry, and then you start painting your picture. Well, we found out that while they were together, they experimented with different recipes for this initial ground layer. And using those differences, we could separate the pictures into batches, and using other evidence from letters that exist that they wrote while they were together, information that could be inferred from what we read in the newspapers, you know, when the circus came to town, when certain things that appear in their pictures could be related to specific events, to weather, to changes of the weather, when they had to paint indoors, when they could paint out of doors. We put this all together, and as a result, we could, for the first time, suggest, I think, pretty persuasively, the order in which these pictures were painted. And as a result of being able to put them in this order, and this, we were able to read the story, read the relationship afresh. And of course, this is something that was both very time-consuming. It also takes a lot of people and a sufficient budget to get this done. And they're doing an exhibition and getting generous corporate underwriting, corporate sponsorship, in this case by Ameritech, that allows a big research project like mm-hmm. this to accompany an exhibition and can produce, we think, a new way of looking at things and thinking about this relationship.
Yeah. And all that detective work has to be done long before you can start to think about mounting an exhibition.
Yes, right? It's a sort of back and forth. We have the idea to do the exhibition, we find a partner, but then we think, then the research starts. So in a way, what you've done is you've determined that you're probably going to go ahead and you're requesting loans. We had been thinking of this show, which opened in September of 2001. We had been thinking of it, the first ideas were 1990. But they remained ideas. The idea of doing Van Gogh and Gauguin grew out of our having done an exhibition in 1988 devoted to the entire Gauguin career. It was a classic retrospective, that is, it looks back from the very beginnings to the very end of an artist's career. Following from that exhibition, we had the idea of exploring the Van Gogh-Gauguin relationship, and the way it came about was that in the aftermath of the exhibition, we thought we might, Peter Zegers and myself, thought that we might pursue what had come out of that exhibition and do a book on Gauguin in the South Pacific, where he ventures in 1891 and spends the last decade plus of his life. He dies in 1903. What we were faced with every time we kept thinking, you know, what decided him, why did he start thinking about travel in that way? Because, of course, he had been a sailor when he was a youth, and he had traveled a lot. But suddenly, in the late 1880s, he begins thinking of a voyage to some exotic place in order to literally pioneer a new style. So the idea of pioneering, like going west, is put in the service of pioneering in a creative sense, that you go someplace new to discover new resources that will enable you to paint new pictures. And how did this come about? And we kept tracing it back to the conversations that Vincent Van Gogh and he had in Arles in the end of 1888. And from there, that was the germ of the idea. In about 95, 96, we were doing other exhibitions, of course, so this was on the back burner. Around 1995 or 96, we were in contact with the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, and they're our partner. They're the logical partner because their collection is not only so rich in the works of Van Gogh, but the collection is the personal collection of Vincent Van Gogh and his brother Theo, who was an art dealer in Paris. And so it also includes the works by Gauguin that the two brothers either purchased or were given by Gauguin in exchange for pictures by Vincent Van Gogh. Once we got to the point of the partnership, the whole question of can we realize this, not just intellectually or as an idea, but can we actually realize it in terms of the loans? Will people lend us the pictures that are critical for tracing this relationship, tracing this dialogue, which was played out certainly in letters, but was also played out on the surfaces of their canvases? At the same time, then you start launching into research to illuminate, hopefully in new ways, a subject which has been dealt with before. And that's, as you said, we were sending people around the world to gather this information. It took 2 years for this research project from its beginning to its end, and it was really only around this time last year that we were beginning to put together all this information to see whether there were any patterns of meaning that emerge from it, so that it comes together. One works in it a very long time, but really it was only in the past year that we had the conclusions of the evidence that allowed us to go ahead and finish writing the catalog. So it's all very, it takes a long time, but inevitably, no matter how much time you leave yourself, you're rushing to the end because these things go on in parallel fashion. But in the end, you want the catalog and the exhibition to reflect new things that you found, and that those new things only come into clear focus near in time to when the catalog is actually through the printer.
I want to talk, of course, very much about the relationship between the two artists, but I do want to go back to the material that they used to paint on their canvases, this jute. As you mentioned, you know, we think of paintings, we think of canvas or a linen-like material that, that artists paint on. What? How common was jute used at all before or since?
It wasn't used before, and it's been used. Gauguin continued to use it, and others have followed him. The problem with jute is that it's not particularly sturdy, so that over time it just literally disintegrates. It's a question of the chemical makeup of the jute. And other people have sought different. I mean, this was the beginning of people beginning to want to paint on different types of surfaces rather than the traditional linen that we associate with old master paintings. They wanted to do it in a way to shake themselves up. I think that Van Gogh and Gauguin went out and bought this very unorthodox material because in a way they wanted to do something new with their pictures, and they felt that if it's, I mean, in a bit, it's, this is too exaggerated, but it's like a right-handed painter saying, well, I think I'll try painting with my left hand. What the jute does is it doesn't allow business as usual in terms of the, if an artist has not worked on a surface like this before, it introduces a new element that he or she has to take into account when painting. And I think that, you know, they said that they did it because it was cheaper, but clearly it wasn't that. I mean, Gauguin was interested in a more, quote, primitive was the term that he used, rougher, more immediate, more direct type of painting is what he was aiming for. And I think that he thought that that this material would aid and abet that by painting on this rough and tumble surface.
Yeah, that material has to demand attention to the way you put down lines and the way you put down color.
Absolutely.
The paint.
Absolutely. And both of these, I mean, Gauguin traditionally, I mean, up until that moment, had been using these very, very thin layers of, he would build up his colors using these very small brush strokes, very thin layers of color over each other. The jute didn't allow that. Van Gogh used what we call a commercially primed canvas. In other words, he would go to someone who sold painting supplies and buy a canvas that already had a ground on it, and he could take it right from the store and begin painting on it. The surfaces were much smoother than this highly textured jute, and that smoothness aided his, or abetted certainly, his very, you know, the way he applies paint in these lush, broad strokes. Well, the, with had to take into account that the normal sort of fluidity that he was allowed with his paint, because he liked to paint. One of the arguments between Van Gogh and Gauguin was how very much Vincent liked to paint so very quickly. And this wouldn't necessarily mean that he had to paint more slowly, but certainly it would mean that he would have to apply the paint differently because it wouldn't go on literally so readily.
Hmm. The two of them apparently had quite a discussion about whether painting should be done spontaneously or you know, over time, carefully and from memory. Talk with us about how the two of them approached the method of painting, whether to do it as it was, almost as you were there and in the moment, as opposed to doing it more slowly, carefully, deliberately, and using memory.
Well, in the 19th century, and it was something that Vincent and Gauguin were both very aware of, there was a distinction made between the study or the sketch that you would do quickly and the what in French is termed a tableau, a painting, which is often built up or developed from studies, i.e., one makes studies of the figure, one makes studies of landscape, and then one takes all the studies, and from the studies one has made, one moves on to a picture which incorporates all of them. That was a traditional way of practice. Vincent, on the one hand, wanted to paint, liked painting very quickly. He liked to really throw himself into the act of painting, and in a way, he liked to have a circumscribed period of time in which to accomplish what he was trying to do. So that if he would go out and paint during one of the windstorms, the Mistral, that are common in Arles, he would anchor his canvas down and do battle with nature and do his best in this confrontation with his chosen motif or site and with weather conditions, and then he would paint that picture. He was aware, though, that he had that some of these he would himself classify as studies. And he was anxious, in a way, to do something that was more significant, what he, of course, termed a tableau. Now, of course, he would sometimes make a distinction. He'd finish a work and say, oh, it's only a study. Then he'd go back and decide, well, no, it was really more than a study. It was a tableau. It was a more fully developed picture that could stand more on its own and represent his achievement. But one of the ideas that he had in mind was that, just as the canvas, the jute that they bought would make them change the way of proceeding. One of his ideas, and he expresses it very clearly, in getting Gauguin to come with him, to come down and stay in the south of France, which Gauguin commits to in June of 1888, but only gets there in October of 1888. One of the things Vincent wants Gauguin to do is to teach him, and also to slow him down. I mean, Vincent will write to his brother and say, well, I'm only doing studies, but maybe if I had more companionship, I would have the patience to develop a picture over time, and I would work more methodically and slowly and develop a tableau. So this is on, and Gauguin traditionally would proceed more methodically. He would come to a new place, he would make little sketches in his notebook, then he would sometimes make bigger figure study drawings, he would make smaller, less ambitious canvases, but then he would make ambitious canvases, more ambitious canvases, which he would do not in front of the model or not in front of the landscape setting, but actually he would do them in the studio. And he would do them, when he says from memory, in other words, it's from your memory of what you've done, but it's also from the works that can be seen in a way as preparatory. And that's what he came to Arles, and he tried to get Vincent to do that. And Vincent, though he wanted to do it, found it very difficult to take on anyone else's ideas. And so there was this, and he constantly challenged those who tried to teach him. And so there was this back and forth, and it was very heated. So that on one occasion, for example, they invite the neighbor, the woman who runs the rather disreputable cafe down the street, to come and pose, and Gauguin, we have it in the exhibition, makes this very beautiful, very deliberated drawing of her in a sitting which lasted about an hour. In that same hour, Gauguin, as he wrote his brother, said he slashed on, Vincent rather, as he told his brother, slashed on this painting of Madame Genoux. So in other words, in the same hour, one man was doing a drawing which he just barely finished, and Gauguin and Vincent had begun and finished a a large scale, I mean, his normal scale painting. And issues about what a painting should be and how a painting should be made characterize the relationship through this 9-week period. And interestingly, one can see each of the two both alternately taking on the other's ideas. You know, Gauguin begins to paint more thickly. He begins to paint more quickly in some canvases. Vincent sometimes allows himself to paint from memory without any model right from his head. He's not comfortable doing it. Sometimes he then rebels and does things his own way, as in painting Madame Genoux in an hour, just to make it very clear that he's his own man and will do as he wishes. So in other words, it's what one would expect with two very creative individuals who have ideas about painting, who are interested in looking at other ideas because they want to move their art ahead. They want to progress very quickly in their art. They're ambitious. On the other hand, they sometimes resist other ways of doing things because they want to remain true to their own notions of their individuality. Hmm. So it's very fraught.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on line one in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hello. I just have a moment, but I thought I think I heard an interview, someone talking about the relationship between the two of them. And I think it was pointed out that they parted at the famous incident of the self-mutilation of his cutting off his ear, that Gauguin came back to the place and found him bloody in bed and left, called Vincent's brother, and never saw him again. It seems to me that it's kind of surprising that such a dramatic thing wouldn't be included as part of the story of Vincent's tribulation.
Oh, in the catalog. We haven't discussed it.
Thanks a lot. I'll be listening off the air.
Okay. Yeah, there's so much to this story.
Well, we do try to look at this whole incident afresh in the book which accompanies the relationship. We talk about it a bit on the audio tour. Certainly that is a very dramatic culmination of this discord between the two. And it was precipitated by the fact that Gauguin had been entertaining leaving. And for Vincent, Gauguin's arrival in the south of France and the so-called Studio of the Tropics, this idea that they would create this outpost and other people would join them and they would revive French painting, that had been the dream of a lifetime come into focus in this yellow house in the south of France. He had hoped, Gauguin was supposed to stay a year. You know, that was the idea. Vincent nourished the idea that he would stay forever, you know, that this would become the enterprise that they would both put their energies and resources into. And so when Gauguin, because of all the fractiousness, because of the disagreements, when he started showing, for a variety of reasons, interest in leaving, Vincent panicked. And I think that the more that Vincent pressed Gauguin to stay, the more insistent he became, the more Gauguin decided that it was time to leave. And what precipitated this incident on the 23rd of December of 1888 was the fact that Gauguin, who had in fact written Vincent's brother Theo just days earlier saying, I have to get out of here, it's not working, I'm leaving, and then had immediately written back and said, we patched it over, it's okay. On the 23rd of December, Vincent confronted Gauguin and said, are you leaving or not? And Gauguin said, okay, I'm leaving. And an argument. Gauguin leaves, decides to spend the night in the hotel because Vincent is too agitated. And Vincent seemingly takes some of the aggression that he's feeling, and he's also feeling in return from Gauguin, out on himself in this incident of self-mutilation. And to sort of understand better why he would choose to do this and then very ceremoniously hand the part of the mutilated ear, of the ear that he's mutilated, to go to the local brothel that both of the artists had frequented and give it to one of the employees there, why he would do this, we try to contextualize in by setting it in some of the things that we know them to have been discussing, including a famous murder trial that was underway in Paris, and their discussions about Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, and part of that story, of course, is Peter cutting off the ear of one of the Roman soldiers, and Christ, in some versions, reattaching that ear. So it's this strange and oblique, but nonetheless symbolic act that speaks to their relationship, and also to Vincent's disappointment, feeling that he was being martyred by Gauguin's leaving. He told Gauguin, when Gauguin said, he was leaving, Vincent basically says, you're a murderer and you're fleeing the scene of your crime. Mm. So in a way, what Vincent is doing is perpetuating the crime. He's sort of physically enacting the crime that he thinks that Gauguin is subjecting him to by leaving him and totally destroying his dreams for the Studio of the South.
Yeah. So there is this culmination of all the tensions between them,
right,
coming to a head. Would it be accurate to say that Van Gogh saw the Studio of the South as a place to set down and remain there for a while at the same time Gauguin saw it as just a stopping point, and he was a man who was always on the move?
Well, I think you're right. I think that what we say is that for Vincent, the Studio of the South was a destination. It was the realization of a lifetime dream. Not that he had, from an early age, thought specifically of a studio in the south of France, but this idea of the artist serving an almost missionary purpose, of artists working together in a sort of spiritual brotherhood of shared purpose and shared ambition. These were long-held ideas. So for him, when it seemed to be coming into focus, he grabbed it and he wanted it to last. And it was his looking forward to it that generated some of his most celebrated pictures: the Sunflowers, the Bedroom. Many of the pictures that we know him best for were painted in anticipation of Gauguin's arrival to make the Yellow House the appropriate setting for this ambition. What happened was, I think, that Gauguin gets there. I mean, he too wants to do things with his art, but he doesn't have this. He hasn't quite thought it through in this way, and he doesn't have the same sense of program. I think the discussion with Vincent is difficult, but it's also enormously stimulating. And I think that that in a way, Vincent stimulated Gauguin to want to leave, not because only because he was a difficult man to be with, but also he had these ideas that Gauguin thought could more dramatically and more successfully, in fact, be carried out by literally taking the enterprise abroad, by transforming the Studio of the South, so-called, in Arles, into a Studio of the Tropics. And so what was for Vincent a destination becomes for Gauguin, and particularly in their conversations, a starting point. And so Vincent spends the rest of his life moving his art forward, but always looking back to the ideal of the Studio of the South, whereas in the immediate aftermath of their breakup, Gauguin immediately starts thinking towards the future and getting away from France. He first thinks of going, in fact, to Cambodia, and then only later decides on Tahiti.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Douglas Druick. He is Searle Curator of Painting and Prints Trust, Curator of Prints and Drawings at the Art Institute of Chicago. He's also the curator of the exhibition Van Gogh and Gauguin, The Studio of the South, which is at the Art Institute through January 13th of 2002. Listeners, I invite your questions. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. The book that accompanies this show, that also serves as its catalog, contains an interesting discussion of two paintings done by Van Gogh, chairs. And Van Gogh paints his chair, and he paints a chair for Gauguin. When you look at those two paintings, what do you see?
Well, what we see, knowing what we do about none of the way the chairs got into the house, and looking at the pictures as if we had knew nothing about this, we see that these are basically what one might call displaced portraits. The chair that Gauguin designates as his, that Vincent rather designates as his chair, is a reed seated chair, which was one of 12 that Vincent had bought for the Yellow House in anticipation of Gauguin's arrival. The other chair, Gauguin's chair, and that's Vincent's terminology, was the only chair in the Yellow House that had that was an armchair. And clearly for Vincent, and it's quite clear in the letters, and it's clear when he paints a self-portrait to send to Gauguin just before Gauguin arrives, Vincent is thinking of basically Christ and the 12 disciples. The number 12 is very important to Vincent, and 12 true disciples. And Vincent paints himself as what he calls a Japanese bonze or monk, and he does so in part because he wants to make it clear to Gauguin that this is something like a monastery, I mean, in terms of it's literally faith in art. And that Gauguin, he says, if Gauguin will come south, he will be the head of this studio. He will be the abbot. And Vincent and the others who will come will play the role of monks. So that already the differences between the chairs and their significance in Vincent's mind is quite clear. And then, of course, you look at these two pictures, and in Vincent's painting of his own chair, the chair itself is simple. Vincent, in talking about it, refers to its simplicity. It's painted in daylight, and initially there was nothing on the chair. After Gauguin left, we've now discovered that was the time that Vincent added his own pipe and tobacco pouch to the surface of the chair. But initially, it was this very simple chair set in the corner of perhaps the kitchen, because right beside it there's a box with onions in it. So it's part and parcel of Van Gogh's presenting himself to himself and to others as this very simple, a simple man, a humble man who is a painter laborer. He's a man of the people. The Gauguin chair is the more sophisticated chair. When Vincent bought the chair for Gauguin's bedroom, I mean, he pointed out that he was trying to make the bedroom that he was preparing for Gauguin, for which the chair was destined, to be truly artistic. And it is the chair that all the sitters that were invited to come to the Yellow House were painted sitting in. Vincent paints it at night, and so it's much more mysterious. And on the wall, gaslight illuminates the room. And this was the gaslight that Vincent had put into the house. It hadn't been there before he rented it. He had it put in to the house specifically so that he and Gauguin would be able to paint after the sun went down, because this was the end of the year and the days were shorter, and he wanted to make sure that they could paint into the evening, and so we had this gaslight installed. So the gaslight is burning on the wall. But on the chair, Vincent, from the outset, put in the Gauguin's chair picture a candle, which is burning, and two books. And we know from the tradition that Vincent was raised in the Netherlands as the son of a preacher, that all of these were emblems, symbols. The lighted candle is a traditional symbol of illumination, and you know, spiritual illumination. The books refer to one of Vincent's abiding passions, which is for contemporary literature, which he saw. I mean, we're talking about the novels of Victor Hugo and Emile Zola. Vincent saw as, in a sense, replacing the Bible, because they contained a message that was more accessible than the Bible, a message to a contemporary audience, to an audience who were dealing with the trials and tribulations of life in the late 19th century, and he thought of these books as a new gospel. So he also thought that what he wanted to do in his painting with Gauguin was to make a parallel achievement in painting. That like the books of Hugo, their pictures would be new gospels that would afford consolation, spiritual consolation, to a new age of viewers, the way Rembrandt had his time. And so the chairs are all bound up in the differences between these two personalities, in the way Gauguin is perceived by Vincent, and in contrast with the way Vincent saw himself. And yet his very failure to paint Gauguin himself face on, but rather to paint his chair, is also telling, because Vincent had been saying how much he wanted to paint Gauguin's portrait, and yet he starts out by painting him in his absence. And then, of course, the absence also refers, arguably, to the fact, of his worries and anxieties about Gauguin's possible leaving. And later, Vincent would refer to the picture of Gauguin as an absent presence.
Another listener is waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
All this, the talk about Gauguin leaving and the mutilation. When I was going through the exhibit, I just wondered, it just seemed to me that that was the kind of a thing you do when you're distraught over a relationship falling. falling apart. I'm wondering if more than just the professional one, was there any evidence that there was a sexual one, or one that Van Gogh hoped that there would be, or is that just pure speculation on my part?
That's an interesting question, a very valid one, and it's been one that's been raised by all sorts of people who, you know, people who devote their lives to art history and people who like to come and see exhibitions. It's a question that's, I think, naturally raised because of the clear passion that Vincent invested in this relationship. When we started out, we thought if that's what we, you know, if that was potentially an option. The more we got to know the two artists, the more we felt that the idea of a romantic or sexual relationship between the two is not part of their history, but it was a passionate relationship. And Vincent also intensely idealized Gauguin. Gauguin was like the idealized older brother. And Gauguin, you know, he does prepare the Yellow House as a, you know, as a bridegroom awaiting his bride. I mean, this is what he's been waiting for. There is an aspect of the relationship that I think is sexualized. I mean, the competition for, you know, Gauguin admired as the ladies' man. Their discussions of, and this was not just something that they did, the late 19th century, was interested in the notion of, or the relationship between creative potency and sexual potency. And in Vincent's letters, there's lots of discussion about the need to refrain from too much sex in order to be able to channel one's energies into creativity. So I think that's all part of the rivalry and Vincent's intense investment in this ideal of the Studio of the South. And I think that it's that intensity which is what leads people, I think, quite naturally, the intensity invested in this relationship. You know, from most of our perspectives, I think that one associates that amount of energy, intensity, and longing with love and sex. I think that one has to take into account Vincent's almost fanatical devotion to his sense of mission and what that meant to him. And so that I think that I don't think that it was a homoerotic relationship. But people have seen in those two chair portraits that we just discussed, that at least on a rather overt sexual symbolism, which other people do not see there. So that's a matter open to interpretation. I think that from Gauguin's point of view, later in life when he's in the South Pacific, he does in his writing refer to an episode where he's going through the forest with this androgynous, you know, teenage boy, and has lustful thoughts, which he then banishes. I mean, I don't think it was absolutely impossible for by any means for Gauguin to be attracted, as he readily admits in this one episode, to someone of the same sex. I don't know that he ever acted on it, and certainly Vincent did not fit the bill. I mean, I think that Vincent was seen by Gauguin as being a difficult personality, and given what we know about his health, et cetera, I doubt very much that he would have been an object of Gauguin's desire. Gauguin, after breaking up with his wife, confines his relationship largely to very young people. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Did Gauguin do paintings that illustrate his view of the relationship between himself and Van Gogh?
We suggest that his portrait, I suppose most apparently, the portrait that he paints of Vincent painting the sunflowers, is this very strange amalgam of that speaks to his ambivalence. I mean, both his admiration for Vincent, his frustration with him, his disagreement about his feeling that Vincent... Vincent's sense of painting wasn't as lofty as his, Gauguin's own, because he insisted on painting from life rather than painting from the imagination. And I think that sort of all feeds together in this strange representation where, you know, you look at this figure, this representation by Gauguin of Vincent, and you think of the self-portraits or the portraits that others had painted of Vincent, it looks like a very different individual. You know, arguably, he's dazed looking. He's either in a trance or he looks somewhat, you know, there's a suggestion of the brute in a way. And in the portrait, he's also very strangely positioned. He's Gauguin literally paints him as if he, the painter, were looking down on his subject rather than looking directly at him. And Vincent is presented almost as if he were being crowded by the man who's painted his portrait. So the thing is, I think it speaks to all sorts of issues that their relationship involved.
Yeah. Sunflowers were a subject for both artists. What drew them to sunflowers as a subject?
I think it comes from Vincent initially, when they first meet in the fall of 1887. Gauguin's just back from Martinique in the Caribbean. Vincent and his brother think the pictures he brings back with him are wonderful, and wonderful in ways that are new to them, that they do not see in other paintings by members of the Paris vanguard. The brothers buy one picture and get another from Gauguin. Gauguin gives Vincent a picture, and Vincent gives Gauguin two studies of sunflowers which he had painted just a few months before. Vincent, because of his upbringing, was intensely aware that the sunflower was a traditional symbol of love, of the soul turning to the divine, and also of secular love, of the lover turning to the beloved, or the, you know, the mother to the child, etc., etc., the friend to the friend. And Vincent was aware of this tradition, and in France, tournesol, literally the name of the flower, sunflower, tournesol, means turn to the sun. So that Vincent, in giving Gauguin this sunflower picture, in a way pays homage to what Gauguin has done himself by following new suns, by venturing to Martinique and painting new pictures in Martinique. And shortly after this exchange, Vincent himself acts on a long-held idea to follow the sun. And he leaves Paris and goes to Arles in the south of France, and there rents a house, then invites Gauguin, and in preparation for Gauguin's arrival, the first of the pictures that he would paint specifically with an idea of decorating, and that's his word, decorating the house in anticipation of Gauguin's arrival, were sunflowers, and he finally decided to put them into Gauguin's bedroom. So that early on it became the symbol, in addition to a traditional symbol, it became the symbol of their relationship and a symbol of this idea that's embodied in the concept of the Studio of the South, the idea of following the sun south and then abroad to pioneer a new art. And what happens is, while they're together, Vincent paints another version of the sunflowers, and Gauguin paints Vincent painting the sunflowers. And after Gauguin leaves, in the month after he leaves, Vincent returns to the sunflower theme and paints two more sunflower pictures specifically to give to Gauguin in response to Gauguin's interest in having them. And then the following summer, Gauguin is in correspondence with Vincent, but Gauguin is now back in Brittany, in France, and in the northwest of France, and Vincent is in the south of France, and Gauguin is working on decorations for the place where he's staying, and one of the pictures that he paints features sunflowers, and in front of them a dark-skinned female, and that we see as a sort of symbol now of Gauguin's intention of taking the sunflower and moving, taking the sunflower or the sunflower concept, what it symbolizes, and transplanting it to the South Pacific. And that's, in fact, what he does. And we close our exhibition with some of the last canvases that Gauguin painted, which included a series of pictures featuring the sunflower and featuring other ingredients that refer back to his time with Vincent in the south of France and their discussions of the Studio of the Tropics.
Yeah, but also very much still elements of the tropics, as in sunflowers and mangoes.
Absolutely. In other words, these are complex pictures. So on one hand, he's referring back and to the relationship and seemingly acknowledging Vincent's formative role in the project that led Gauguin to the South Pacific. On the other hand, he's saying, in a way, see, look here, I've transplanted this idea to the tropics. He's obviously nostalgic and still very ambitious. He writes to friends in France and says, "I'm lonely. Please send me seeds so I can grow flowers that will give me some consolation in the absence of hope." He specifically asks for a variety of sunflowers. And the sunflower pictures, I think, are these very are complex in the way his earlier portrait of Vincent painting the sunflowers were complex. They acknowledge both, I think, indebtedness, but they also assert independence.
Douglas Druick, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. It's really been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure being with you.
Thank you. Douglas Druick, our guest this afternoon. Van Gogh and Gauguin, the Studio of the South, continues at the Art Institute of Chicago through January 13th.